Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I am your host today, Susan Franzen, together with my co-host,
Pat Schlarbaum.
Hello, Pat.
Hello, Susan.
Our program today is about how people in Ames are thinking about climate change. Now, we know that's a pretty overwhelming topic, and everyone knows something about it and has an opinion. So we're sampling some of those opinions and some of the thinking behind them. Our purpose is to inform and stimulate your thinking. We hope that this will raise some questions as well as give you a chance to look at some things in a new way. For that, we are taking two recent events which have some political overtones, not partisan, that's not our business, but advocacy of various kinds, from what we should do about fossil fuels to how we think about the food we eat. To balance that, we'll visit a climate scientist who's doing research in this area at Iowa State. For our first stop, I'd like to take you back to a beautiful afternoon in September. There's a group gathered here on the corner of Welch and Lincoln Way with a lot of signs. And they say such things as climate justice. Keystone XL pipeline spells climate disaster. And I hear occasional honking from people going by, so somebody knows what this is about. But I'm just assuming that a lot of people don't, so I'm going to start asking people why they're here. The very first person I spoke with gave a pretty good summary of the issue, but I didn't catch his name.
I'm here because I think that we need to have some more publicity about the Keystone XL pipeline. It's a pipeline that is designed to carry tar sands oil from Alberta, Canada, down to the U.S. Gulf Coast. And it's a bad idea for many reasons. One is that the tar sands are very dirty oil. The other is the pipeline is likely to spill and cause a whole lot of problems. But the most fundamental thing is that we need to stop building infrastructure for the old kinds of energy. We need using new, renewable, clean energy rather than keeping going with using oil and other kinds of fossil fuels, which are dirty for the environment, they're bad for the climate, and alternative energy, the best reason in my mind for doing it is that there's so many good reasons to do it.
For a description of the event, I'll put on one of the organizers.
Hi, I'm Rivka Fidel. I'm part of ActiveUS, we're an environmental activist group, and I'm also part of 350.org, which is an international organization dedicated to keeping carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere down to 350 parts per million. And we're here today as part of Draw the Line, which is a national event organized to get Obama to draw the line on the tar sands and say no to Keystone XL. So that's why we're here. We've managed to get people partially because 350.org has a very large influence. They send emails out to thousands and thousands of people every day. And so the people here represent people who are connected to 350.org in one way or another, whether through their friends or family or through Iowa State, because we did send out emails to many people.
Well, is this the only demonstration today, or are there others?
There's hundreds of them, actually, over 200 in the United States and Canada. They are drawing the line today in New York. They're marking how high the water levels got from Hurricane Sandy, for example. And there's lots and lots of other ones. I think there's two or three more in Iowa.
Next is a local environmentalist known to many of our listeners, Irv Kloss, retired professor of animal ecology and wildlife research biologist at ISU. He's wearing a sweatshirt with a fisherman logo embroidered on it. Is there any special reason for that, Irv?
I'm Irv Kloss with Ames Anglers On because fishermen and hunters are beginning to wake up to the fact that climate change is bad for them. They want to continue that form of recreation. They've also got to get involved, and get involved quick, because we've got to leave this fossil fuels in the ground. We cannot afford to have more CO2 in the atmosphere. We just have to cut, because they really are worried in the Arctic about the the ice sheet disappearing, the Arctic Sea, and it's getting smaller and smaller. And there's a slight pause in the warming right now, but by 2015, it's going to jump really fast because we're releasing methane from the methane hydrates that are frozen in the bottom of the sea. And with the sea warming up so fast in the Arctic, that could cause this methane to be released, which is a worse greenhouse gas than is CO2. And that will accelerate this rate of warming that we're experiencing and accelerate all of the other effects that we're seeing with the climate events that we're seeing with flooding and drought and so on. So it's really critical, and our politicians don't seem to pay attention to it. In fact, most of them are denying that climate change is really happening. And if they admit that climate change is happening, they deny that it's human caused. All of that is erroneous, and it's misleading the public, and we've got to get something changed. And I am in favor of a tax on carbon at the wellhead, at the mine, and at the port of entry. That would put a tax on carbon, cause the fossil fuel companies to change direction, and that all of that money would be collected and returned to the individuals and the public to offset the potential of increase in energy costs for them. But this is not my idea. It was proposed 5-6 years ago by James Hansen, a well-known climatologist with NASA. And Hansen says that we need to impose this tax and return the dividends to the people. And it would cause essentially a cascade of things to happen. I think the sooner we do that, the better. So if you haven't heard of the Citizens Climate Lobby, please do look it up and get involved, because we've got to turn the politicians around, and it's we the people that can do that.
Now, I'll just pass the mic to those who were willing to make short statements telling why they were there and why they opposed the Keystone XL pipeline. I didn't catch everyone's name, for which I apologize. So let's hear what they have to say.
So I'm Carolyn Heising. I'm a professor here at Iowa State in engineering, and I'm very concerned about climate change and the risk. I'm an expert on risk analysis, and Professor Fritz Branson just gave a guest talk in my class and convinced several people who were skeptical about the human side of it. A lot of people believe that the climate's changing. How can they deny the forest fires and the Colorado flood of 1 in 1,000 years? How can they deny Hurricane Sandy, Hurricane Katrina? But many are still skeptical whether it's humanity creating it through the combustion of mostly coal. So Dr. Franson certainly convinced many with his calculations. And so we as engineers interact with the scientists, and we need the cold hard facts from the scientists, and the scientists are telling us this is happening. So as engineers, we're going to have to start responding, and as responsible citizens, we're going to have to start recognizing the vulnerability of our communities to climate change, and we need to stop the Keystone pipeline, and we need to support the activists out there who are trying to affect the political process.
And just a little farther down the line is the scientist who visited Carolyn's class, Fritz Franzen, a physical chemist. I asked him what he said that was so convincing.
Well, I think that the first thing that I said of importance on that particular issue is that it is known from statistics that the government has collected that we are producing 30 billion tons of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere annually through the combustion of fossil fuels. And on the other hand, it is known from data that have been collected for more than 50 years in Mauna Loa in Hawaii at the NOAA Observatory there, that the amount of carbon dioxide that is entering the atmosphere at the present time is about 16 billion metric tons. So we're producing about twice as much carbon dioxide as what is actually appearing in the atmosphere. Now, this causes into big question the people who say, oh, I believe in global warming, but I don't think humans have anything to do with it. The question is not where the carbon dioxide is coming from. The question is where it's going. And the relevance to this KXL demonstration is that my concern about the pipeline is not what it's going to do locally, which is bad enough, but what it's going to do globally. It opens another source of fossil fuels that has the potential of doubling or tripling the problems that we're facing right now. And those are problems that are pretty obvious to anybody that thinks about them. And so the question is, do we want that? And the way to say no is to say no to the XL pipeline.
We're here because we don't think that it's an appropriate thing for the U.S. to be supporting a pipeline that goes through the country with possible leaks and spills that's really just for export to other countries.
Really, it's for export. A lot of people believe that this is for energy independence.
No. It doesn't really have much to do with energy independence. It's mostly because of the value of the oil and how easy this would make and profitable to make to export that oil. But the notable problems with the pipeline that a lot of people don't know is that one of the biggest sections of the pipeline that's at risk is the part that crosses the Ogallala Aquifer, which is the aquifer that supplies North Dakota, South Dakota, southwestern Minnesota, Iowa, Kansas, Nebraska, Missouri with water for crops. So when you're talking about putting one of the biggest volume pipelines, transporting the most viscous oil that's been transported via pipeline with the same specifications as all the other pipelines transporting less viscous oil, there's obvious problems with that, especially from like a human health or water quality standpoint. If there's any kind of a leak, it immediately affects millions of people for the long term. So,
well, I thought I heard that Secretary of State Kerry had said that they would reroute it so that it wouldn't threaten the aquifer.
They're rerouting it. They're rerouting it around some places of national interest, like state and federal parks. You know, preserved areas, but they're not rerouting it around the aquifer. My name is Paul Doffing.
And you?
I'm Jen Tillman.
Glad to be here. I have the best sign, though.
Yes, but okay.
Pipelines always spill. It is the reason I'm here. Pipelines always spill. Don't want it in my aquifer.
Canada was doing really well with its carbon emissions in reducing them until the tar sands discovery, and then all the corporate wealth rushed in and the government caved or went with them, and pretty soon, you know, Canada is going to be supplying way too much carbon emissions through those tar sands than the Earth can possibly deal with right now. And I think the Canadian people would have chosen differently, but, you know, I think they would have preserved their boreal forests. There's another thing that we can't afford to lose on this planet, which the tar sands are eating into pretty badly and polluting the area there for the forest. So that's just the beginning, and then it all comes down here in the pipeline. And so that's just one bad thing after another. So we're trying to stop it at whatever point we can.
Could you introduce yourself?
I'm Joyce Emery, a longtime resident of Ames, and call myself the Green Granny. And I have a couple of blogs that I started, but
you like to say what your blogs are in case any other Green Grannies are interested?
www.greengranny.org and www.greenseniors.org. And they are complimentary. One Green Granny is just me, and Green Seniors involves some other people.
Don't turn a blind eye. What's happening is really happening, and once it's gone, it's gone. There's nothing we can do about it. People need to be aware.
I'm Angela Duncan, and I'm here because I want the environment to stay healthy and so I can continue enjoying outdoors, and I want to have a great future.
What's your sign say?
The sign says, Keystone XL, no fracking way.
But does Keystone XL have to do with fracking?
Well, not directly, but it does have to do both the Keystone pipeline as well as fracking are both pillaging the earth. And we are here because we believe that is not the way that we are supposed to pursuing energy sources. We should be looking for sustainable sources instead of fracking the earth and trying to find all of these tar sands and trying to squeeze as much out of the earth as possible and try to soak all the fossil fuels in when we have so many sustainable resources that are actually going to suit all of our energy needs. I mean, if we want to save the earth, we're going to have to change. And part of that is changing the way that we currently get our energy needs. And part of that is changing our own lifestyle habits. And that's just a fact of life. We're all going to have to change if we want to keep living on this earth.
You'd like to give us your name and talk about your sign.
My name is Susan Bramstecker. And my sign says that I pledge to risk arrest to stop Keystone XL Pipeline. I feel that the pipeline is just absolutely going to allow too much carbon into our environment, and our Earth cannot handle it. It's going to kill life in the future, and I'm a mother, and I feel like we just absolutely have to take action now.
And here's a familiar voice to those listeners at KHOI, Pat Schlarbaum.
Yeah, and the message we hope to convey today is the pipeline is just one little piece of a big jigsaw puzzle of carbon complexity. And the carbon, it's very simple. Leave the carbon in the ground. And things like the XL pipeline, they're not of the future. If it's not sustainable, if we've learned anything, it's not of the future.
Well, thank you.
Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in central Iowa. So far in our program, we've been hearing from some people in Ames for whom climate change is an important issue. As Pat Schlarbaum said earlier, the Keystone XL pipeline is just one piece of the puzzle. Next, I have an interview with Bill Gutowski of the Department of Geological and Atmospheric Sciences at ISU. A climate scientist. As I climb to his office on the top floor of the agronomy building, I wonder what he'll have to say.
The reason that I'm interviewing you today is that on September 21st, there was a demonstration, Draw the Line, a national event to urge President Obama to draw the line on the tar sands and say no to the Keystone Pipeline. Which, by its very nature, is a political action, demanding that the government not go through with permission. And I think many people dismiss that as mere politics or an extreme group, because there were only about 30 people there. As someone who works in this area, whose research is there, what do you have to say about that view of politics?
There's science and then there's politics. The science is our understanding of what we know about how nature works and what human beings are doing to how nature works, and in particular with what humans are doing that affects the climate of the Earth's climate system. How we respond to that, what measures a government takes, of course, gets into politics. But there's some fundamental science that has nothing to do with politics. It has everything to do with understanding the fundamental laws of physics, conservation of energy among them, and how those play out in our climate system, especially when humans start to alter the climate system through increasing greenhouse gases.
Well, now I have a question about the matter at hand, the matter that the demonstrators were demonstrating about, the Keystone XL pipeline. What do you have to say about that?
It's pretty clear that we're on a path towards increasing greenhouse gases and therefore changes in climate, some of which could be rather substantial. And so anything that promotes continued use of fossil fuels is really just keeping us on that track. Anything that takes us away from that track is something that will help reduce the degree of climate change. We can't stop it from occurring completely because we've basically got the flywheel spinning and we're already headed in a direction towards warming. But we could certainly take steps to reduce the degree of warming, which will be especially important for our children, our grandchildren, their children. In other words, there's things that we can do now that are going to be very important for our descendants, the people that we pass our planet on to. And so some of this comes down to what kind of a legacy do we want to leave behind. And again, I will remind everybody that the fundamental physics shows that humans are indeed causing the Earth's climate system to retain more energy, and that is going to manifest itself in warmer temperatures and other associated changes like melting of land ice, sea ice, rising of sea level. First of all, I want to remind people that the physics behind our understanding of climate change is not highly complex. We've known about it for over 100 years. In fact, the first computations that were done showing how increasing carbon dioxide could raise the Earth's temperature were done over 100 years ago by a Swedish chemist named Arrhenius. There's been debate back and forth. For a while, people discounted what he did because they misunderstood how changing greenhouse gas levels in the atmosphere affect the ability of the planet to retain energy, but eventually people came to understand more clearly what he did and the implications of it. And it's been discussed and it's been batted around back and forth in the scientific literature for at least three or four decades now. A lot of the hard physics, a lot of the central issues here are things that you can understand with basic college freshman level physics. Not everybody's had that, I understand, but it's something that we're not talking about rocket science here. We're talking about something that a college freshman is capable of understanding, and with a little bit of algebra, you could arrive at the same conclusions that people running these very complex Earth climate system models arrive at as well. The basic physics is very simple. The science is very simple, and that needs to be kept in mind. This is not a matter of opinion. It's a matter of the laws of nature, the laws of physics, and you can't argue that away. It's a basic fundamental fact about how the climate system operates. Once you recognize that, then it gets into the question of how do we respond. That starts to get into the political realm. But I would tell people that if they understand that there's a basic physical issue here and that there are consequences that we are facing down the road, then it's important for them to get involved in this political issue. There are many ways that we could be responding to this that cut across the whole political spectrum. You can talk about free market solutions if you're really somebody who believes in that the markets provide the solutions. You can talk about governmental solutions. But one way or another, these things have to be debated, but they have to be debated on the basis of good fundamental science and not simply people throwing out random opinions or taking facts out of context and trying to just dismiss the whole thing. Global warming caused by humans is real. It's happening. It's going to continue to happen. And people need to understand that and start getting into the real discussion that needs to be done, which is what are the best ways to approach resolving this issue for the best of all humankind.
Well, what are some of the steps you think that people can take if the government is unresponsive, as it seems to, as many parts of it seem to be?
Certainly, you know, the first thing they can do individually is try to just consume less energy themselves. This would mean that asking yourself a question every time you want to go somewhere. Do you really have to drive your car? Is it possible you could ride a bicycle, maybe even walk? And then in terms of the vehicles you buy, there's some vehicles that are much more energy efficient than others. how you live in your home. Are you always conscious of the energy that you're consuming, and are there ways that you can consume less energy? Then extending out a little bit further, you can start to raise the same kinds of questions with your local officials, you know, people that you might have more direct influence over than somebody in Washington. You can say, well, what are we doing when we operate our municipal buildings? Are we being as energy efficient as we can? When we start to build new municipal buildings, are we trying to get as high a LEED rating as we can that would signify that we're really working hard to be energy efficient? So things like that that promote energy efficiency. One other thing I would also could also mention is that oftentimes if you buy food that's produced more locally, it's not transported as far, so that means there is less energy consumed in bringing that food to you. You would still want to look into seeing how much energy was consumed in producing the food, but anything that's transported a shorter distance at least has a smaller, what you would call carbon footprint, because it just used less energy to get transported to where you are. And then you can start to expand further. And then you can start to say, okay, now you can start to try to raise this issue with your representatives in the State House and your representatives in Washington. Representatives may not necessarily respond just to one person's voice, but if it starts to become a repeated voice, they're going to have to pay attention to it, because at the end of the day, they have to get voted into office. And no matter how much money they may get from certain outside interests, if they don't get enough votes to win an election, then they're going to lose their position. So if enough people start raising the issue and start talking about how it's important to them and how it's going to influence their vote, then they do have to start paying attention to it. They might want to just give it lip service in some ways, but they're still going to have to keep the issue out there. And as long as the issue stays out there and people are thinking about it, you can't just pretend it's not there and just act like nothing is happening.
Thank you very much.
After our formal interview, I asked Bill where he saw the greatest danger from climate change. So I'll share those thoughts with you also.
What we are potentially doing to the foundation of the food chain by ocean acidification. I don't think we're going to kill off life completely, but, we're already putting major stresses on the ocean in terms of overfishing and dumping garbage there and everything. And so then you start to make this change in the acidity levels, and it's especially in high latitudes, because the carbon dioxide gets retained just like carbon dioxide gets retained in a bottle of pop. When it's warm, it loses it more rapidly. So the warmer oceans don't keep it as much as the colder, higher latitudes. And so it's really the high latitude ecosystems that are, even now I think, are starting to show some signs of it, but certainly would down the road, just because you take, the ocean tends to be slightly alkaline. As you reduce that, shells get affected. So the microorganisms that have carbon-based shells start to get affected. So that could really be the major danger that's lurking here in all this that's not quite so obvious to people. It's also, speaking of the Arctic, the Arctic has had roughly twice the warming that's gone on elsewhere. I keep saying that the people living, especially the native peoples living around the edge of the Arctic Ocean, are becoming climate refugees simply by staying where they are, because their whole culture is built, or their different cultures are built in part on living in this frozen environment, and you start to reduce that and change the environment, and it's cultural dislocation. There's just all sorts of problems that get created.
This is KHOI-FM, and so far in this program, I have been talking with citizens taking political action to make the public aware of the dangers they see in the Keystone XL pipeline, followed by an interview with Bill Gutowski of the Department of Geological and Atmospheric Sciences at ISU. For the next piece of the puzzle, we'll move to something most people wouldn't associate with climate change: food and agriculture. For that, I was fortunate to have a short interview with Frances Moore LePay before her presentation at the UCC Church in Ames on Thursday, October 17th. While her concentration is on nutrition and agriculture, she gives us a lot to think about regarding the causes of climate change and ways we can address it. So, I invite you to listen in.
The main reason I wanted to interview you is that I have admired you, well, since 1975, when I first bought Diet for a Small Planet, the first revised edition, already a 1 million copy bestseller. I now gather it's 3 million copies. You moved on from that. I know that you've done lots of other things, but would you like to talk about those early discoveries? Because it was... Should I tell you what I remember?
Yeah, that
I
would
haven't,
be great.
I really haven't looked at it for decades.
Yeah, that's interesting. Then.
But I remember eating lower on the food chain, and that if everyone did, that there would be no hunger because there would be plenty of food. And I have had other questions about that because, of course, when you wrote that, the population of the Earth was 4 billion, and it is now going on 8.
Well, it's a little bit over 7, yeah.
A little over 7. But they're already projecting when it's going to turn 8.
Right, which is completely in our control, of course. I mean, throughout the global south, all the increase in population today is in poor countries. So we know that poverty is a stimulus for population growth because women, especially in poor countries, have so little control over their fertility. They don't have access to contraception, and often they don't feel they have a choice in the family. But really, it's amazing to me how many parts of the world, I mean, except for a few countries, mainly in Africa, we're almost at replacement level. In fact, we are very close to having the fertility rate just replicate our current population. So really the question about population is simply, are we going to step up and help everyone in the world have the choice to choose, you know, to choose the size of their families? 20% of all births in the world today are unwanted. And so if we even were able to avoid a huge portion of that, we would have no population growth whatsoever. So we're almost there to replacement level. But the question is, what will we do in terms of women's rights and poor addressing poverty? So I just want to make that clear, that because often you hear that population growth is expanding fast. It's not at all. No. It's slowed down radically. And it's Latin America, for example, is now at replacement level.
The whole Latin America?
As a whole, yeah. It doesn't mean that every part of Latin America, but as a whole, yes.
Mm-hmm. And this is without terrible plagues, or there is, of course, starvation.
Well, there's hunger in Latin America, but parts of Latin America are doing a lot better than most of the world in terms of most of the global south, for example, compared to South Asia. I mean, India, for example, which has massive food stockpiles of grain. Last year, there were 71 million tons of stockpiled grain in India. I calculated that that would give every day for 1.3 billion people who live in India, that would give each person a cup and a half of grain every day, cooked grain. And yet half, that's just the stockpile, right? That doesn't count the food supply. And yet half of the children in India are stunted by malnutrition. So hunger today, just like then, is not caused by scarcity of food.
That was the first idea, the eating lower on the food chain. The second, of course, was nutrition. The nutrition part, that you could eat well without eating meat.
And of course now we know that so much, in fact, I now call it plant and planet-centered diet is the healthiest for us and the Earth. I mean, we now know that the food system overall contributes as much as half of global greenhouse gas emissions because our food system is so much involved. It's the main driver of deforestation, for example, which is a huge contributor to climate change. Also, our chemical fertilizers contribute nitrous oxide, which is a very potent greenhouse gas. So now, of course, there's so much more reason to have a healthy farming and healthy eating, because it's our bodies and it's the sustainability of the growing resources themselves. I mean, when I wrote Diet for a Small Planet, we were just beginning to feel the pain of pesticide overuse, of water depletion, now the Ogallala aquifer, which supplies groundwater for the Midwest. I mean, it's estimated that big chunks of it will be unusable in 25 years because the water table is lowering. So my point is really that we just know so much more now about what is a planet and plant, a plant-centered diet, how healthy that is, and we know so much more about how beneficial that is for our bodies and for the Earth. There's just, you know, when I wrote Diet for a Small Planet, it was absolute heresy to think that you could live well without meat. But I, you know, now, of course, every doctor is recommending that people eat more fruits and vegetables, less animal food, and you'll be much healthier. So my views are, even though I don't eat meat, I mean, I'm not in any way saying that the whole world needs to become vegetarian. Clearly, there are ways, very important contributions that livestock can make to soil fertility and to well-balanced ecological agriculture. So the question is really about the concentration of control in our food industry. And this is, you know, you summarize the message of Diet for a Small Planet, that is, if we individually changed our eating habits, then there'd be enough food. Actually, even with the massive feeding, more than half of grain now goes either to livestock feed or to agrofuel or to industrial use. So human beings now eat only 43% of all grain do we eat directly. And even still, there are enough calories in the world to feed everyone. So the real question is, what I try to make clear, and I keep working on it, is that it is our economic rules that end up concentrating power that then end up in a world in which people who, you know, would like to make dollar or, you know, rupee demand for grain that they can eat as a mainstay of their diet, they can't because they're too poor. And so there's an illusion of this cheap grain that then makes perfect economic sense for those who can to turn it into a raw material, in a sense, to produce something that's higher priced, which is grain-fed meat, which is not very healthy for us. So it's the economic incentive. It's not bad people, good people. It's what are the rules that we've created that so concentrate wealth. Today in the world, half the world's population lives on 1.1% of the world's wealth. And that is the results are bad for all of us in the sense that this massive centralized system produced not only grain-fed meat, but highly processed food, so that today calories are not, we can't measure food, our food problem in calories anymore, because you can have adequate calories and still be made sick by your food. I just have been in touch with a doctor in rural India who has, in their clinic, has 2,000 patients every month. And these are very people below the Indian poverty line. And so they're not urban dwellers eating Big Macs by any means. And yet 60% of them have diabetes and heart conditions because their diet is so unhealthy, eating polished rice and soda and other things that are unhealthy. So this highly concentrated system, whether it be junk food in the United States or, you know, highly processed snack foods that and soda and that sort of thing, that to me is also a symptom of a highly concentrated food industry that can then afford to you know, advertise and occupy all the shelves in the supermarket with things that are highly processed and aren't really healthy for us. So there's no, you know, there's so I could go on and on.
Well, that was the other concept, was that Americans are unhealthy because of an overconsumption of protein.
No, not overconsumption. That was just to show that we eat about twice as much protein as our body can actually use, because we don't store, on average, our bodies don't store protein. So I was just using that to suggest the degree of waste in this system of we don't, there's a, we have an idea that we need these massive amounts of meat to get enough protein. That's diminished a lot. I was just making that point to show that we need a lot less than we think we need, and that we can get plenty of it through plant foods.
Right.
And if they're healthy.
And your diagrams for complementary proteins were very interesting to me, because I figured out pretty soon that these are the traditional foods.
Yes, yes, I love that.
You know,
part.
Corn and beans,
right.
And
rice
beans
and
rice,
also.
And
right,
lentils.
Right.
Yes, rice and lentils. And
So
it's easy to find recipes. You
absolutely.
Just go to your Indian cookbook, your Mexican cookbook, and
And I think, you know, again, I'm not advocating that everyone become a vegetarian, but we now know that animal foods traditionally have been sort of not the center of the plate, right? They have been for special occasions and condiments and seasoning and that sort of thing. And somehow, again, reflecting an economic system, not what people, nobody sat in their kitchen and said, I want grain-fed, fattier meat. I don't think anybody did. But there was a lot of advertising, oh, you know, this fatty meat, all that marble, and it got graded by USDA higher. That convinced people that this was status, this was luxury. And now we're paying the price in heart disease and now in diabetes with so much processed food, especially, of course, high fructose corn syrup and so much sugar. The most horrifying statistic I've heard, well, single one, well, two I'll mention. One is 40% of the calories that children in the U.S. eat now are empty calories in the form of these, you know, sugars and fats. The other is that in this world where there's more than enough food for all of us and, you know, and only 43% of grain actually goes to people, in such a world where of abundance and much more potential abundance, one in every four children is stunted, physically stunted. And that is a medical condition that is lifelong impairment. It involves malnourishment in the womb in the first 2 years of life, and you can't recover that loss. And so these children don't do as well at school, they don't do as well economically as adults, they're more prone to disease. One in four of our children. That is the crisis beyond calorie hunger, is this degradation of our food throughout the world. So it comes in so many different forms, but mainly in the shift toward highly processed food. And that's why I'm just so excited about people discovering the joys of whole foods. And, it, you know, this, how satisfying it is. And your body, you know, I think I can tell the difference when, you know, that when you're eating the fresh produce or whole grains. I mean, you can almost feel your body thanking you and the vitality returning. And I was just on the radio in San Francisco yesterday, and many callers called in about their health who, you know, said, oh, I read Diet for Small Planet and I've just been so healthy all my life. And then a gentleman called in and said that he has congestive heart failure because he ate a very bad diet. And he said, now, you know, I'm reformed and I'm feeling better. But, you know, I think people are waking up. You know, I think there are these moments of, I think it was moments of dissonance when you think you go along, well, this is the American way, and then suddenly, wait a minute, you know, I'm taking 20 pills a day to try to feel well. Maybe my diet, there's something wrong here. And when even rural people in India are getting diabetes, there's something really that never happened before. You know, this is all new. I really think that it's a time where people are saying there's something foundational that we have to rethink, that is partly nutritional, but it's also partly about democracy itself, creating rules that make sure that wealth is spread and power is spread, because we know that dependency is not what human beings did. We didn't evolve to be just sort of go along. You know, human beings evolved to be problem solvers and contributors and decision makers, and I think that you know, people taking back responsibility for their food is it really? I can just see people come alive, especially young people, with this idea that you know, you just don't have to go along with a way of eating that we know is now not healthy for us, and a way of using the earth that's not healthy. And it's not about making people wrong in that sense of blaming. I mean, this is, we're all, you know, I wrote a book called EcoMind that is my most recent book. And it's all about rethinking environmental messages. But the key theme is, from an ecological perspective, you have to realize we're all connected. Everything is continuous change. We're all co-creating things. So the whole idea of finger-pointing is ridiculous, because if we're all connected, then we're all implicated, right? So you can't just blame, oh, well, somebody's, you know, advertising something. Well, where am I to step up? And, like, my daughter now has a brilliant project, video project, that is challenging the big food industry for advertising directly to children, which I find completely unethical, because children are so vulnerable, they don't have any way to weigh what's good in for them. So, you know, it's up to us to step up, you know, and to say, no, I can take charge. So I still find food, after all this 42 years now, I still find food a great liberator, you know, mind clear. You know, you sort of follow the food and politics and economics, and you can make sense of it.
Food first, right?
Yes, yes. That was the name of, that is the name of the organization that I co-founded in 1975.
You have been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. We have just heard from Frances Moore LePay, whose bestseller, Diet for a Small Planet, has surprising implications for climate change. Earlier, we spoke with Bill Gutowski, climate scientist in the Department of Geological and Atmospheric Sciences, and several Ames residents advocating against building the Keystone XL pipeline. We have time now to announce another approach from Rob Hoag, state senator from Cedar Rapids and author of America's Climate Century. Pat, could you tell us a little about him and what he's doing now?
Senator Hoag has certainly become an energetic climate advocate. He's a real strong voice. His latest action to increase awareness is a series of events scheduled in Iowa to remember Hurricane Sandy, October 22nd through October 29th.
I just received an email from him saying, "We are asking Iowans to remember Hurricane Sandy during the week of October 22nd, the first anniversary of the formation of the hurricane, to October 29th, the first anniversary of its landfall in New Jersey and New York City. Hurricane Sandy was a transforming moment in American history when Americans saw an unprecedented late October storm bring record storm surges through downtown New York City, New Jersey, and much of the East Coast. It killed 117 Americans, ruined thousands of homes, vehicles, and businesses, destroyed public infrastructure, and cost our country more than $70 billion, or more than $200 per American. It showed us what is at stake with the issue of climate change and the need for climate action. During the week of October 22nd to 29th, we will remember the victims of Hurricane Sandy and other climate disasters, renew our commitment to help survivors, and unite for climate action to prevent future disasters."
Rob then lists events in Iowa City, Dubuque, Fairfield, Des Moines, and Cedar Rapids. So far as there's nothing in Ames that we've heard about, it's probably worth mentioning that several of those cities suffered devastation in the flood of 2011. It's too bad if that's the way people have come to become aware that there's a problem.
Well, I guess that's why we're doing this program, isn't it, Pat?
Absolutely.
Though below me I feel no motion, standing on these mountains and plains, far away from the rolling ocean, still my dry land heart can say, I've been sailing all my life now, never harbor or port have I known. The wide universe is the ocean I travel, and the earth is my blue. My sail and moon, my rudder, as I ply the starry sea, leaning over the questions into the deep. Drifting here with my ship's companions, all we kindred pilgrim souls, making our way by the lights of the heavens in our beautiful blue boat home. Thanks to the waves upholding me, hail the great winds urging me on. Greet the infinite sea before me, sing the sky my sailor's song. I was born upon the fathoms, never harbor or port have I known. Wide universe is the ocean I travel, and the earth is my blue boat home. The wide universe is the ocean I travel, and the earth is my blue.
It's about time to sign off. This is Local Talk at KHOI-FM, where we've been discussing various approaches to dealing with climate change. If anyone is interested in learning more about Citizens Climate Lobby, just check out citizensclimatelobby.org. That's CITIZENSCLIMATELOBBY.ORG. Thanks to all of those from the Draw the Line on the Keystone XL pipeline demonstration, to climate scientist Bill Gutowski, and to Frances Moore LePay. To learn more about what she's doing, check smallplanet.org, smallplanet.org. Local Talk is engineered by Richard Morrison. Background drumming for the demonstration was the title piece from the CD Heritage from Change the World Production, Incorporated. Other music was Blue Boat Home by Peter Mayer from his CD Earth Town Square. You can also listen to this show and all of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. And see listings of our past guests and resource contact information. If you enjoy this show, tell your friends. Most of our support comes from our listeners. So if you'd like to help us build community radio in Central Iowa, please contribute at our website. Send a check to KHOI-FM at 410 Douglas, Ames, 50010, or come by our studio at that address and see what's happening. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 515-292-2878. Or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. Your participation as audience makes KHOI possible. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.
ocean I travel.